Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Back in August of this year, 2017, I was walking through the BYU bookstore. I was attending the Education Week, so I happened to be on campus a few days. And as I was about to leave the BYU bookstore, I heard someone come over the intercom and say that Elder John Groberg was on the bottom floor of the bookstore signing copies of his book. And I thought, oh my goodness, here's my chance to meet, you know, an emeritus, first quorum of the 70, somebody who has a fantastic life of service, who served a mission in Tonga. And so I went. I went to the bottom floor and met him, got a few copies of his book and had him sign those books. And then I swallowed my pride and I said, Elder Groberg, would there be any chance you'd be open to allowing me to interview you on a leadership podcast that I produce? And he didn't give me necessarily a direct yes or no at that moment, said, here's my daughter, talk with her. She'll give you my email and we'll go from there. And I'm so grateful to say that that interview actually did happen. Now, if you're new to Leading LDS, welcome. My name is Kurt Frankum. I'm the host of the Leading LDS podcast. And I encourage you to look for the episode called New to Leading LDS, Start Here to learn more about Leading LDS. And I welcome you. So back to my story, Elder Groberg was kind enough to allow me to come to his home after some email correspondence. I was so excited to get this interview lined up, and his wife, Jean, was so kind to let me into their home and to interview him. Now, if you're not familiar with John Groberg or Elder John Groberg, if maybe you're younger, you may be more familiar with his story that was portrayed in a movie called The Other Side of Heaven, which tells about his experience as a young missionary in Tonga. Now, he was a member of the First Quorum of the 70 for just about 30 years. And this is the first Quorum of the 70 individual that I've interviewed on the Leading LDS podcast. So definitely a milestone in the Leading LDS progress. So I think you're going to definitely enjoy this movie. Now, I want to say a few things before we jump in is that Mitch Davis is the director of The Other Side of Heaven. And he actually just came out with a new movie called The Stray, which I was invited to an early screening of The Stray, and it was fantastic. Really good story. Be great for a date night for any of you leaders out there that need to break away from the stress and frustration of leading and just go out for a date night with your significant other or with friends and go see The Stray. It's out in theaters now across the country and well worth your time. And Mitch Davis was definitely important in connecting me to Elder John Groberg and encouraged Elder Groberg to definitely consider being on the Leading LDS podcast. So, and finally, before we jump into this interview, I want to encourage you to go to leadinglds.org, hit the donate button, and become a core leader. Now, what's a core leader? These are donors that are contributing on a month-to-month, year-to-year basis. So they've set it and forget it. They're giving as little as $1 a month, $12 a year, or more. And we can't continue to produce this quality content for the leadership audience without your help. And another cool thing coming up is we actually have a core feed of the podcast that's coming up in the next few weeks, where core leaders will have exclusive access to not only the week-to-week podcast episodes, but additional content. We're going to push out the weekly webinar audio through this podcast feed. We're going to have bonus episodes and additional content from various interviews that we do that only will be accessible to core leaders. So nothing's going to change about how the podcast is now. They're just going to be additional content for core leaders who are subscription donors. So be sure to go to leadinglds.org and hit the donate button. And now, here is my interview with Elder John Groberg, Emeritus 70. Today, I'm not too far from my home in Bountiful, Utah, in the home of Elder John Groberg. How are you?
It's fine.
Good. I appreciate you taking some time for us to chat. We actually ran into each other. You were at the BYU bookstore during Education
Week.
Is that something you typically do? Or
no, that was the first time I've done it, in fact.
Oh, really?
Or maybe the second, yeah.
Yeah. And you were kind enough to sign some books for me, and I was a bit nervous. I asked you, hey, would you ever consider doing an interview for my podcast? And here we are. I appreciate you being open to that.
Thank you.
Now, how long have you lived here in Bountiful?
We've been here since 1978. That is, it's been our home base. We've lived in Hong Kong and Argentina and Tonga and Hawaii and Idaho Falls during that time, and we've just rented it out. But we've been here ever just shortly after I was called as a general authority. They asked us to be in the Salt Lake area.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure many listening that are
you know, I was, you were giving conference talks before I was even born. So, but I remember you, and obviously on my mission, I was serving in Sacramento, California. Uh-huh. And I remember the day that my mission president called us and said, "Hey, guess what? I'm taking you to a movie." And we thought, a movie, wow, on our mission, we can go to a movie theater. And there we went and saw The Other Side of Heaven. And so tell us about how did that movie come to be? And for those maybe not familiar with you and your background, what context could you give us?
Well, the genesis of it was when I was serving as mission president in Tonga, the youngest member of the Quorum of the Twelve at that time was Thomas S. Monson.
Oh, wow.
And so he was our supervisor. Uh-huh. And he came many times to Tonga while Gene and I were serving as mission president. And I guess he heard a lot of stories. And shortly after I was called as a general authority, he talked to me one day and said, "John, you need to write a book about your experiences as a missionary in Tonga, because that's a chapter of church history. If you don't write it, it's going to be lost, because the way your mission was is not the way missions are going to be much in the future."
That's for sure.
And so I said, okay, because I'd never thought of doing that. And then a little while later, he said, "Well, how are you coming?" And I said, "Well, I'm still thinking about it." And then a little while later, "How are you coming?" And I said, "Well, I've got an outline." And as you deal with President Monson, you know that, and I've learned it over time, is that you do what he says when he says it.
Sounds like he wasn't going to let it go either.
So he quickly realized, he says, "Okay, John, I'll give you 1 year. I want the manuscript on my desk 1 year from today."
Oh, my goodness. A deadline.
So I ended up writing the book. And when I handed it to him, he read through the manuscript, I guess, and said, this is very good, but it doesn't say anything about when you were mission president." Mm. And I said, "Well, you said when I served as a missionary in Tonga." And he looked at me and he said, "You don't consider being a mission president a mission?" Because, see, he didn't serve as a young missionary, yeah, but he did serve as a mission president. And, of course, I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm sorry." And he said, "No, you got to write another book. I'll give you 2 years on this one." About when you were mission president. But anyway, that first book, at the time it was called In the Eye of the Storm. Mm-hmm. And years later, a person that had been with Disney read the book, and at the urging of some friends, he decided to become an independent filmmaker. Mitch Davis is his name. And when he read it, he just thought, I'd like to make a movie of this.
Wow.
And I had nothing to do with that at all. But when they came to me and said, "We'd like to make a movie, we'd like to buy the movie rights," I said, "Well, you'll have to talk to the First Presidency. It's not my book. It's their, you know, they asked me to write it."
And oh, okay.
I'll have to get permission from them. So they did. And the First Presidency said, "As long as you stay close to the book, you don't, you know, wander off like sometimes."
Like they do in Hollywood. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
"We'll give you permission to do so."
And did they wander off too far?
No, they, when you take, the book is like 300 pages, and you can only get about 100 pages in a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
So they had to leave a lot of things out, and then they combined a lot of events, but everything happened. Mm-hmm. But the sequence was maybe slightly different, and sometimes they would combine two events into one.
Yeah.
But yeah, everything happened, and we didn't even see the movie until it was finished. We just trusted them that they would do right. And first time we saw it, President Hinckley, when it was done, said, "Well, I would like to see it before, you know, it goes public." And so he called a special meeting in the Legacy Theater in the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. And all the general authorities that were in town that day came, and Gene and I came, and that was our first time to see it. And as we sat next to President Hinckley and President Monson and President Faust at the time, we were scared because we didn't know what the movie was going to be like. Yeah. But it turned out they enjoyed it when it was over. I felt a little more comfortable as time went on when President Monson would say yeah or, you know, positive comments, and President Faust leaned over a couple of times and said, I like that, and President Hinckley similarly. But when it was finished, President Hinckley got up and just said to Mitch Davis, who was in front, just poked him with a cane and says, good job, young man. I like it. I think this movie will do a lot of good. We'll see you.
And off they went to the next meeting.
Yeah.
Wow. And you had didn't you have a cameo in the movie during the wedding scene?
Yeah,
is that right?
That's right. At the wedding scene, I know President Monson has often told me, he said, you know, my favorite part of the movie? And I says, what? And he says, seeing you and Gene wave goodbye to yourself when you get married.
Nice.
We just happened to be in New Zealand on another assignment when they were finishing up there. And they said, you've got to be in this scene. So I'm hiding behind a camera and my wife's got a big floppy hat on, and we had a couple of other family members there. But anyway,
yeah,
that's just, you wouldn't notice it unless you're looking for
right.
it.
Right, exactly, exactly. Now, when President Monson asked you to, you know, put this manuscript together, I mean, you've gone on to write other books. So was this kind of, yeah, were you a writer before this, or was this sort
not
of your...
really? No, that was really the introduction. I wrote that one. And then, as I mentioned, that second one was about when I was mission president. Both of those were by assignment. And I just had the feeling, well, since it appears that they're helpful to a lot of people, maybe I ought to continue writing. And so I've written actually a total of 5 books now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, and even some as recent last few years, right?
Yeah.
And really, a lot of them have paralleled some of your service
right,
a temple president,
right,
who wrote about the temple.
Right.
As you approach a book project, or is it an idea that comes to your mind, you think, oh, that, I think that would be a good book, I'm going to dig into that?
I actually just have, from the beginning, I didn't really think much of, I mean, my missionary experiences, even though they're relatively unusual at the time, they seem just normal to me. I mean, that was just the way things were.
Yeah.
But as I see the principles that come from them that are helpful to people, and as I've received literally thousands of letters of appreciation, I realize, well, you don't go about it to become famous or to right. get praise. But if it does help people, then it's worth the effort. It's a lot of work, as you know. Writing a book is a huge project. It's not something that I just sit around and say, hey, I'd like to write a book. It's, but as I think, well, what should I do with my life? And, you know, the Lord's given me these various experiences, and if they're helpful to other people, then I shouldn't hold back. And so that's kind of the way I approach it.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to go to some of those topics that coordinate with some of the callings you've had. But, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with you, obviously, as the missionary on the other side of heaven, but also as the member of the First Quorum of the 70. What was your life like before that call to the 70? Obviously, you were mission president. What other callings before that of leadership did you have opportunity to serve in?
Well, after my mission, my first mission, we went on to school for a few years. I got an MBA from Indiana after graduating from BYU. And Gene and I were married just shortly after I returned from my mission. Then we moved back to Idaho Falls, where I went into a family business. My father was into insurance and real estate and farming. And I just kind of went in to help. And we ended up going into construction and land development, which my father was one of the most wonderful men you could meet. But he grew up in the Depression, and he was very, very opposed to getting into any kind of debt. And it's hard to build houses without getting loans. So my brother graduated from the Y and came up and helped. And we worked for quite a few years just in building, sort of in connection with, but separate from my father, because he just simply refused to to sign anything that would, but it worked out very well. So that's what we did, is we built homes and some light commercial. We didn't ever get into any. We were never very big, but it was a successful business.
And then this is in Idaho Falls area?
This is in Idaho Falls. And then actually a year after I came back from Indiana to Idaho Falls, they called me as bishop of our ward. And it was a young ward and a growing area. We had about 500 members, and a year and a half later, we had over 1,100 members in our ward. It was, one of those growing areas. Yeah. And I talked to the stake president about dividing it, and he said, well, you can't divide it until you have a place to meet, because all the buildings were full. The whole town was growing. And
back then, it wasn't like today where all of a sudden a church pops up. I mean, there's some funds that have some fundraising.
Yeah, at that time, we had to raise 50%, and the church would come up with 50%. Wow. So it took us a little while, but we eventually got the building built, and the person that was assigned to come and dedicate the building was Gordon B. Hinckley. He was a member of the 12 at the time, and so anyway, we finished the building. Then after that, I was called as mission president.
So you went from being bishop to mission president.
Right.
Wow. During that time as bishop, is there a certain principle or concept, like if you were to give it one piece of advice to a new bishop from your experience as a bishop, what would that be?
Well, I don't know that I can limit it to one.
Right, that's tough, right?
But I think, obviously, the most important thing is to rely on the Spirit of the Lord. I know a lot of promptings that you receive are very counterintuitive. Mm. I'll just give one quick example. I remember of a lady who was a member, but not active, and her husband was not a member, but they had a couple of children, but they didn't come. I talked to them, and he said, look, we go fishing and camping on weekends, and so we're just not available. I'm not even interested in. And I remember of going to a training, a state conference, from some general authority. And part of the training was, you never call people on the phone. And that's right. You should call them in the office.
Extending a call.
Yeah, yeah. But I was in the office, bishop's office, and I just had this. I was going over the list. I had a list of all the people in the ward. In those days, we had IBM cards, and I had everyone's name listed on it. Wow. And I just had it divided into two categories. One is people with callings, and the other was people without callings. And so I just prayed about who should be where, and the objective was to get everyone with a calling. That was kind of the feeling I had. And this particular time, I looked at this card of this girl, and normally would just set it aside because her husband had said, we're not going to be interested. And I just had the feeling, just give her a call right now. And call her to the primary. And I hesitated for a minute, but the feeling was, give her a call right now. So I picked up the phone and gave her a call and talked to her and said, I'd like to extend a calling to you. And she says, Bishop, you know that you've already talked to my husband. He says, we can't, we're not here on Sunday. I said, I know. This is a calling to the primary. In those days, primary met on Wednesday afternoon.
Right? Yeah.
And it was just after school, and the kids all just came to primary. And I said, no, this is to primary, and it's on Wednesday, and you could bring your kids, and it wouldn't interfere with your weekends at all. And I'm sure your husband says, well, he happens to be here right now. Let me just ask him. Uh-huh. And because he worked out of town quite a bit, but he was there right then. And he said, no, I don't know if it's Wednesday, as long as it doesn't interfere with our weekends. So she accepted the call, and over time became quite active. And of course, when they did the primary program, they said, oh, come on, Daddy, please come, to the program. Anyway, to make a long story short, within a few years, it wasn't immediate, but within a few years, he took the missionary lessons. He joined the church. They got sealed in the temple and so forth. And I thought, it was just that moment right then that needed. So I think that's the thing, is to respond to the Spirit and then look at everyone, not for their problems or talents or anything, but just the idea they have an opportunity to help build the kingdom of God. How does our Father in heaven want them to do it at this particular stage in their life? Mm-hmm. And that was the idea, was 100% participation if we possibly could.
Yeah. Wow. So then you went from being bishop right on your mission.
Right. Yeah.
How soon did you find out you were going back to Tonga? Was that pretty soon in the process?
Or? Actually, it was a very unusual thing. Today, you know, they interview people ahead and mm-hmm. find out what their work schedule is. I actually was serving as bishop and enjoyed the work that I was doing there and had no idea that anything was coming. And one day Gene called and said, "John, you better come home and there's a letter." And I said, "What kind of a letter is this?"
And how old were you, just to put this into the perspective?
I was 27 at the time.
Wow. Okay.
Well, no, I was 27 when I was called as bishop.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I'm sorry. And I served for, it was just short of 5 years, about four and a little, well, basically 5 years. Uh-huh. So I was 31 when he called me as mission president. But anyway, when Gene said, "You better come home," and I said, "Well, what is it?" And she said, "It was a letter from Salt Lake." I said, "Well, bishops get lots of letters from Salt Lake." She says, "Yeah, but this one says Elder John H. Skroberg, not Bishop John H. Skroberg."
My goodness. Right on the envelope.
Right on the envelope. And so I came home, and there was a little FP up in the corner, which I learned later meant the First Presidency. So opened it, and the letter just said, "Dear Elder Groberg, you are hereby called to serve as the mission president." This was in late April, and you're to report to Salt Lake in the middle of June for a mission president seminar. And that was it, you know. And I said, Jean was expecting, we had four daughters at the time, she was expecting a child. And I remember my first question to her was, "How quick can you have this baby? We've got to be in Salt Lake on June the 20th or 25th, whatever date it was." And I didn't know quite what to do. I kind of talked to our stake president, asked if he knew anything. I didn't tell him because it said to not say anything until, it actually said until you receive an official letter. And I wasn't sure if this was the official letter. And so I could tell the stake president didn't have any clue of what was going on. And so I just kind of kept quiet. And a few days later, a good friend of my father's came up, and he was, he had just been called as mission president to Hawaii, Brother Woodbury. And as he was talking, I said, "Well, you seem to feel free about talking about going to Hawaii." And he said, "Yeah, they when they talked to me, they said, don't say anything until you get the letter. And once you get the letter, then you can tell people."
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, okay." So when he left, and that evening I talked to my folks and said, "Well, you know, I guess this is the letter then. So we're going to go on a mission." So anyway,
but
that's
in
the
that,
way.
In that initial letter, it didn't say anything about Tonga. That
no,
came as a,
that's
another
right.
letter.
Yeah.
Did you get any
just,
phone call from Salt Lake?
No,
or
never. No. But just within the next day or two, we got visa applications and, you know, passport things, and it said to Tonga.
Oh, wow. It wasn't even the official, like, "You're hereby called" type of letter. It was,
well, it says you're hereby called to serve as a mission president.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then not when you find out where, right?
No. And so that was a couple of days later. That kind of came through Murdoch Travel at the time.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. So were you hoping to go back to Tonga? I would imagine. I mean,
oh,
I think
we would love. I think that's true. Every missionary would like to go back to where they served. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the travel arrangements come, and you sort of, I mean, there's not, now I think when a mission president is called, there's sort of, let's gather the family, the letter's here, you know, we're going to open the letter and read it, but that you didn't have that type of scenario.
No, we didn't. But of course, when we did find out and everything, you know, because we had to take passport pictures. And I remember, Gene, this was kind of the end of April, and the baby was born about the middle of May, and we were waiting on passports because she had to be born. I know on her passport, it says age 1 day.
Oh, my goodness.
So just as soon as she was born,
yeah,
we got her picture. And of course, Jean was still in the hospital. And I know when Jean saw the passport pictures, because I just kind of worked with the kids, and she was really aghast because some of the girls had jam on their faces. And, well, you could have cleaned them up a little better. Well, I just wanted to get the passport pictures done. So
sounds like you're a husband.
Yeah.
Many of us can relate to. That's great. So you go off to Tonga, and I'm sure this was a three-year assignment.
Right.
And interacted back with the people you were familiar with.
Right.
And to be honest, I didn't know there was a book about your time as a mission person. Yeah. I'll have to check that out. What about the mission stands out as far as your personal leadership development?
I think the main thing, again, was on an individual basis. I think I've learned quite well, because it's been pounded into me, that groups are fine and you have to deal with them, but the Lord cares about individuals. And if you're going to get help from the Lord, yes, he does give revelations that apply to everything, you know, like, well, for instance, as mission president, I had the impression that we needed to hold a 50th anniversary jubilee, golden jubilee, for the church being in Tonga for 50 years. So that was a general overall.
Yeah.
And those come. But I would say 99% of the impressions I had were call this individual or talk to this person, or, you know, something like that. Of course, as a mission president, you deal with the missionaries one-on-one. And at the time, we had no stakes, so all of the members were in wards or ranches and districts, so they all came under the mission president.
Yeah. And so that, I would imagine that was sort of your first feeling of being a general authority, right?
Right.
That everybody looked at you like, you know, you are the general authority of this country.
Right.
So you had to be proactive about reaching out to the one, and because it's easy to go to meeting, right?
Right.
But to be proactive in reaching out.
Right. Calling district presidencies and branch presidencies, working with the district presidents. And my experience was that you just worked, when you got the right person in the right place, then you give them as much authority as they possibly can handle and try and stay out of their way other than giving them direction.
Yeah.
But I would say that I was very blessed because there were good leaders there. The Tongan people are wonderful leaders. I mean, they have their problems like everyone else does.
Yeah,
but
sure.
But just generally speaking, they were loyal, they were true, and they were hard workers.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just from your mission experience as a younger missionary, from, you know, the other side in heaven, just the raw faith of these people, you know, and some of those experiences where, and I love the experience that you also mentioned in one of your conference talks of, I forget the exact verbiage, but I will be the Lord's wind or something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
What a great principle of, you know, sometimes that miracle doesn't come and we have to be the miracle, you know,
right.
That's great. Anything else about your time as a mission president? We could talk several hours on this, but that stands out about leadership.
Well, I think the idea that that the Lord's going to solve all your problems is maybe kind of overblown. What he does is he gives you the strength to handle. He doesn't solve them necessarily other than, I mean, he doesn't make them go away. He just gives you the strength. One of the big things was the birth of, we had five daughters first that we took with us down there. And I was good friends with the king and the queen because I had known them on my first mission when it was prince and princess.
Not too many people can say that phrase you just said. I was good friends with the king and queen.
But the queen often said, because Jean was expecting, you know, partway through the mission, And the queen said, well, you're going to have a boy. You've got five girls. Time to have a boy now. You've come to Tonga to have a boy. And we did. When the baby was born, it was in Tonga.
Oh, wow.
Was a boy. But unfortunately, he was born with some congenital health problems. They turned out to be kidney problems. We didn't know what they were, and they didn't. And so, you know, you just think automatically, well, we're here, we're doing the Lord's business, and he wants us, you know. And then when all of a sudden it dawns on you that you've got a child that's really, really sick and probably isn't going to live. He just got totally dehydrated. President Monson came through. He was up and down and up and down. And President Monson was there and saw... He was in a pretty good state at the time, but we told him that he'd been up and down, and he just observed and said, well, keep me informed. And then we went to Fiji. We toured the mission together, and Fiji was part of our mission at the time. And he left for New Zealand, and I went to the airport to fly back to Tonga. And at the airport, I got this call. And one of the airport attendants, it's a fairly small airport, and I flew in and out a lot, so they knew who I was. And he said, Mr. Groberg, you have a telephone call. And I said, well, I've got to catch this plane. And he said, oh, I'll hold the plane for you. Take this take this call. Uh-huh. And it was Elder Monson. He was calling from New Zealand. And he said, John, I said, how's the baby? And I said, well, I was just going back. I got a call from Gene saying that he's kind of taking a turn for the worse. And he said, well, I'm here in a barber's office getting my hair cut, but I just had the impression. Call President Groberg and tell him to have his wife go to the States and take the baby. So I got back to Tonga, and John Enoch, our little son, was really in bad shape. He was totally dehydrated. Top of his head was caved in. His eyes were way back in his head and listless, just not even crying. It was just a pathetic sight. And of course, we prayed and prayed. And then we found out that the saints and the missionaries all fasted and prayed. And even the queen and many people who weren't members of the church fasted and prayed also. And I got this knock on the door when it just looked like he was fading out. And some of the leaders came and they just said, President Groberg, we just wanted you to know that he's going to be all right. We fasted and prayed and the Lord told us he's going to be all right. But you do need to follow the advice of the brethren. I told them that President Monson or Elder Monson at the time had asked us to take him to Salt Lake. But the doctors there said, no, he wouldn't last, so don't even consider that. But they said, no, you need to get him. And at the time, they did the very best they could, but they just didn't have the equipment. They didn't know what was wrong with him.
Right.
They knew he needed fluid, but they didn't have any baby needles, so there was no way they could get...
Oh, like an IV or something.
Yeah, and they couldn't get it into his veins because he was so dehydrated and collapsed. Everything was... And just then, a doctor, or a TMP, they call him a Tongan medical practitioner, just arrived back from training in Australia, actually just the day before, and he said, you know, they taught me a procedure called a cut-down, and you do something in the ankle and you balloon up the vein, then you can stick an adult needle in. And he did. He did it, and he got the IV, and his eyes kind of came back a little bit, and he filled out. And so the doctor said, well, I think you can take him to, I think he'll last.
Oh, wow.
To America.
Wow, what a miracle.
So... But then, of course, the big problem we had is how do we get him into America? Because they don't have an embassy in Tonga, an American embassy. And, you know, so we couldn't get a passport. But I talked to the British consulate there, and he gave us what we call a certificate of identity. And we called the American consul in Fiji, and he said, yeah, we'll accept that. So anyway... They got Gene and the baby got back, and they found that he had a very serious kidney problem, but they were able to operate and fix it. And he's now married, and you know, he served a mission in Brazil, and
wow,
has a son that served a mission in Bolivia, and one that's presently serving in Ecuador. And so anyway, back.
I'm so glad there's a happy ending to that. What a great story, miracle for sure. So you come home from your mission, and was it just a few years later you were called as a
When I came home from my mission, we arrived home in July, and in August they called me to be a regional representative. Mm.
And that would be similar to an area authority now?
Right. It's the same as an area authority.
And that, for those, are you set apart as a 70 or ordained to the office of 70?
At that time, we were just set apart as a regional representative. They called it a regional representative. I was living in Idaho Falls, and the region they gave me to supervise was the South Pacific. So I commuted, you know, I would go to state conferences. So my commute to Tahiti and Tonga and Samoa and Fiji and, you know.
You spent a lot of time on an airplane.
25,000-mile commute round trip for conferences. But it was wonderful.
And was that, I wouldn't imagine it was every weekend you were.
No. I probably went 4 or 5 times a year is all. Because I would combine state conferences, you know, hold one in Samoa, one in Tonga, and one in Hawaii maybe or something like that. But that went on for 7 years. And then...
And during this time, you're running your business.
Right, yeah.
You're living your life. You're being a father.
Yeah, yeah. And so we had more, you know, children and business and so forth. But I was gone... normally, I was gone for 2 weeks, sometimes up to 3 weeks, but 4 or 5 times a year. So that took a big chunk out of my work schedule.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
Fortunately, my brothers were very helpful in the way things went on. 7 years, they released me as a regional representative after 7 years.
Was that typical time frame for a regional rep?
Yeah, it was. Well, they kind of indicated 5 to 6 years.
Gotcha.
This went on 7. And so when I was released in December, I just thought, okay, well, that's wonderful. And then I got a call from Elder Hinckley and wanted me to go on a, he was going to create a new stake in I can't remember where now, and wanted me to come with him. And I just mentioned, I said, well, I've just been released as regional representative. And he says, what does that have to do with it? Are you going to come with me or not? I said, well, yes, I'll come with you.
Yeah.
And so at April conference, then they called me as a general authority.
What do you remember about that interaction of actually receiving that call? How did that work back then?
I just got a call from Salt Lake from Arthur Haycock. And he said, President Kimball would like to visit with you tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. Can you come here to Salt Lake? And I said, sure.
And you're in Idaho Falls.
I'm in Idaho Falls. So I drove down. I didn't tell Gene anything about it because I assumed that I knew they were planning a regional conference there, and I just assumed that he would want to talk to me about, you know, details of, and so.
So Gene didn't go with you?
No.
Okay.
And so I went in, and President Kimball just talked to me for a few moments and called me as a general authority, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. He's a great, great man, and I said, well, yeah, sure. And is it all right if I tell my wife? Because this was just a few days before conference.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, sure. So anyway.
And during that time, I mean, there wasn't this emeritus status mm-hmm. of 70. So did you receive this as if this is the rest of my life calling?
Yeah, that's right. He said, you're here. I'm calling you to serve as a general authority for the rest of your life.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And so it was a wonderful, I had great, great interaction with President Kimball and First President Monson and President Hinckley that were, anyway, it was just a wonderful, wonderful period of time.
And during that time, it's full of visiting stakes. And did you
right.
go back to
well,
the South?
What Pacific? Happened is my first assignment, I was living in Idle Falls, as you know, and on a sustained at April conference. Then they said, now your first assignment will be to move to Hawaii and supervise all of the Pacific Islands.
Wow.
And Hawaii's closer than Salt Lake. And
yeah.
So, and then we were there for a couple of years, and then they called us back to Salt Lake. That's when we came here.
Oh, and moved into this home.
Right.
Right. Wow. During that time, you know, visiting, you know, I would guess maybe thousands of state conferences during that time. And a lot of time you are a companion to maybe an apostle or another 70 or area rep. Any, and you know, I love these stories where they talk about, you know, I was going to a General Thurdy may mention, I was going to a state conference with Elder Maxwell or whatever it is, and he taught me this great principle. Any specific story that comes to mind? I'm sure there's many of them, but any that come to mind?
Well, of course, I've been to many state conferences with President Monson, with President Pack, well, all of the brethren, and Neil Maxwell, I remember, and Bruce McConkie, Elder McConkie, I should say, Elder on all of these. Some of the ones that I remember at the time going with LeGrand Richards, for instance, and I remember we went to a state conference in Arizona, and we flew to Phoenix, but it was up in Holbrook, so we drove up, and I asked him a few questions, and he said, are you really interested in church history? And I said, I really am. And he says, all right, but once I get started, it's hard to turn me off. And so for Classic. Several hours, he just taught me church history, everything he remembered, you know, from, and he was a real character. He had a way of telling stories, but as I look back, every one of them had a principle involved. And basically, the principle was be obedient. Mm. Just be obedient to the brethren. And I remember going with Elder Maxwell when he was kind of in the latter stages of his cancer treatment. And it was up in Logan. And again, we drove him up. And I remember of him saying, now, I normally don't do this, but I have a feeling that I'm not going to be around very long. So I want you to conduct the sessions, have the intermediate hymn right after an hour, and then just turn the rest of the time over to me. He said, I normally don't take that long, but I just feel like I should take that last hour because I don't think I'll ever get back here. And again, I thought, what a humble thing. I mean, normally, you think humility is just saying a few words.
Yeah.
But he was not feeling well, and he had that impression, I should spend this last hour or most of the hour. And he just bore testimony, basically, and taught. So, you know, you just, it was all over the board. And I remember others saying, you know, I really feel like a half an hour is plenty, and others longer and shorter. And I realized, you just have to go by the Spirit. There's not one size that fits all.
Yeah. And what did you learn, whether from these brethren you went with or others as you went to different state conferences, about just running a meeting and organizing a meeting, presiding over a meeting? Any thoughts that come to mind about that?
One of the things I learned very quickly was that it's hard work. Yeah. I remember being with President Kimball on several occasions when he would, he just interviewed and interviewed and interviewed, and he just talked to everyone. And others didn't quite, you know, they would talk to, but not to the extent. Everyone is different. I just learned the Lord touches different people. But I remember one time of President Kimball saying, okay, now, John, I'm going to lay down for 12 minutes. And he said, I want you to stand by the door and don't let anyone in for those 12 minutes. And literally, he laid down on the carpet floor.
And like in a state president's office or something. Wow.
And by the time I closed the door, he was out. And I thought, well, I'll time. And so it got close to 12 minutes, 11 minutes or something. And I thought, well, I don't know whether I should go in or
don't want to interrupt, not. Wake him up or startle him.
And I just heard a knock on the door. And he said, okay, ready to go.
Wow. Next interview, huh?
Next interview.
Wow. That's interesting. And so, and that's, I think that's helpful to see that what I'm hearing you say is that, you know, every general authority that may visit a stake handled it differently.
That's right.
And approached it through their own inspiration and spirit. And there wasn't a right or wrong way necessarily.
Yeah, that's right. There's about three principles that really stand out. Number one is you go by the Spirit. Number two, you express a strong testimony. And number three, you express love for the people. Mm-hmm. And that comes out in the testimony, and it comes out as you respond to the Spirit. So while I say everyone is different, they're all alike in that sense.
Mm-hmm. That's
great. They all bore strong testimony. They all exuded love for the people, and they all followed the promptings of the Spirit. And that's where the difference in the different, and that's what the scriptures say. There's differences in administration. You know, this stake needs this. This stake needs this. This time and so forth. But I was very, very blessed. I remember Elder McConkie on a few occasions. I was with him in Arizona, and he was suffering at the time, just like Elder Maxwell was. And I remember of him going through, and I said, "Now, is there anything I can do to help you?" And he said, "Yeah." And he went like going 100 miles an hour, and he says, "When I'm through, I'm through, and I want that to be the end, you know, not other things after." And I thought, well, you know, he gave his all,
yeah,
and then that was that, you know.
And he kind of drew a boundary there.
Yeah. Right?
So was he referring to like when the meeting's over,
it was actually, yeah. He just said, it's kind of hard to explain it. I mean, it wasn't like closed or anything like that.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, this is it. I've done now kind of, let's just get to the airport and go.
Yeah.
Whereas I was with President Monson at a temple dedication, and I remember the security people saying, "We've got to go. The plane's waiting." You know, he says, "Oh, tell them to wait a little longer. I've got people I want to talk to." So the idea is the Spirit touches different people in different ways at different times. But I think those principles of following the Spirit, expressing love, and bearing strong testimony, that's what a calling as a general authority is, to testify of the Savior, testify of the prophet Joseph, of the restoration, and do it in a loving way, and yet be responsive to the Spirit. Where I remember once when we were living in South America and going to a state conference in Chile, and it was the first time, one of the first times where when we sustained the state president, there were
opposition votes. Oh, wow.
Once in a while I'd seen it, but this was like quite a few. And I really had the impression, don't let this pass. Take care of it right now. Uh-huh. And so we stopped the conference, and I called the people in. They had some very serious concerns.
Yeah.
But it wasn't done behind the back. I mean, I had the stake present there. And anyway, we were able to reconcile everything. But it was something that had to be done. It had to be reconciled. It wasn't just something that would have gone away.
Yeah.
Normally, if there's one or two, you talk to them or have them talk to the stake present or something. That's the only time I felt that impression to do that. But we did, and it worked out. And So
I'm curious, did end up being a different stake president?
We got it worked out.
Oh,
there were some fairly serious misunderstandings.
Mm-hmm. They just had to address and clear up.
Yeah.
So was everybody waiting in the chapel as you
They
were
just waited. Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, we'll be back.
Sing a hymn or two. How interesting. So what was the, obviously on weekends as a general authority, at a lot of state conferences. What was the day-to-day like for you? Did you have specific responsibilities that changed or?
Yes, I worked in various callings at church headquarters, a lot in the family history. Hmm. It used to be the genealogy, but family history, priesthood department. I remember when I worked with the church magazines and would part of my assignment was to read the articles before they were printed. And, you know, it's amazing. The Lord blesses you. I don't particularly look at myself as a good editor or a good reader, but I read every word of every Friend, every New Era, every Ensign for a couple of years, you know, or several years.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I could do it again, but when you're called to do something, you're given special blessings.
Yeah.
And I would go through and there, not a lot, but that there's something wrong here.
Huh.
And
they'd look into it further or address it or, wow. Obviously, as a 70, you're called upon to speak in general conference, and we just came out of general conference this past weekend. Now as we record, what do you remember as far as that preparation process and the delivery and presentation process of giving a talk in general conference?
Well, it is a lot of work. It's not something where you just sit down and receive inspiration and bang bang. Here's where you've heard from a lot of the brethren how many different drafts they go through.
Yeah, they even mentioned that this past one.
And it was the same. It was the same with me. I would say even on writing chapters in the book, my wife types them all, and it's like 20 drafts before you get to the final. Hmm. It's the same with general conference talks, maybe even more, because you're trying to refine it right down to exactly, and you're very prayerful. And I would say that most of the talks, you always pray about what the Lord wants you to say.
Because you're not given an assignment or a topic.
Right. And most of the time, I had a fairly good impression of the general idea and would go that way. I remember one particular talk that I was working on, and it just wasn't working. And I was over to a state conference in Hawaii, and I just had a feeling that I needed some time. So I asked the state president, I said, I'd like to spend some time, a few hours alone here. And I did. And as I was working on this talk, and the impression just came to me very strongly, that's the wrong direction.
Hmm.
And the reason you're stymied is because that isn't the message I want you to give this time. And I had, and then I really was just kind of, okay, then what? And and it took a long time and a lot of prayer and a lot of, you know, you talk about wrestling with the Lord and or with angels. Well, there's wrestling in the spirit. But finally, the idea came. Okay. And as soon as the idea came, it just flowed.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than 20 drafts, probably 4 or 5, you know, and it was done.
Yeah.
But I can testify that the brethren are inspired when they give their talks. This is not something that they just, what would be good? And no, it's what does the Lord want me to say?
Yeah, there's a wrestle in that process. And I would imagine, I mean, it's not that, you know, you can't, if you're speaking Saturday afternoon, you can't be, typing out some things Saturday morning, right? No. I mean, there's a deadline there, right?
Well, yeah, and of course you have to get it in ahead for the translators and so forth. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. And that's helpful to hear that it's a process that, you know, we like to sometimes romanticize revelation that, I just sit down and just write it out. But there really is this wrestle of getting that message clear so that it can reach the audience it needs to reach, I would imagine.
And like I say, sometimes it's 20, 30 drafts, and once in a while, in fact, I guess only once, that I can say that it was pretty clear. It still took a few drafts, but like 4 or 5 rather than 20 or something like that. So the Lord, he gets his message across through the brethren are called by the Lord. He gets his message through them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's fascinating, to hear about. So, and then if I remember right, in the, I want to say early 80s when this emeritus status was established, right?
I don't remember the years.
Okay. Do you remember when you heard that news, you thought, I guess I will be sort of, I won't be in the mix intensely.
Yeah, it was, I've never had a problem with whatever the brethren say as you meet with them week after week and monthly in the temple and you watch the spirit of inspiration.
Yeah.
I was very involved with the revelation on the blacks, I remember, and receiving the priesthood. And I can just say I have zero question that the brethren are guided by the Lord. Mm. He's in charge and he gives them revelations. Yeah. So, and when that came, it was not hard for me at all. It was, well, the brethren say that, that means that's the Lord's will.
Yeah.
That's just, so it was not something that you fought.
Yeah. Then you just look at what's the next step. You know, how do we move forward, right? So as you were, it was 2005 that you received emeritus status, right? So this has been about 30 years.
I've been 30 years, yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's a, there's some ward organists that don't even serve that long. But so what to, help us understand what an emeritus 70, are there roles? Is it that is just, I mean, is there any function for you now as a?
Well, of course, when I was put on emeritus status, President Hinckley called me to be president of the Idaho Falls Temple. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it kind of was extended for 3 years. They don't do that anymore.
Oh, really?
They're pretty much just, that's not part of being emeritus. Uh-huh. There was a time when a lot of the emeritus brethren were called as temple presidents, but not that's, and there was, you know, it was a little bit flexible. I was 71, for instance, a little over 71 when I was given emeritus status. But now it's just...
Right. And that birthday hits.
It just takes a little time to finesse the process.
Yeah.
And since we've moved back from Idaho Falls to here, after serving as temple president, which incidentally was a marvelous, marvelous experience. They did ask me to... They actually specifically asked me to accept every request I could to speak particularly to the youth. And so for many, many years, we spoke this all over.
Yeah.
That's kind of tailed off as, you know, I remember President Hinckley one time when I was in a meeting with him. Well, I was still an active general authority, and someone was praising him and said, oh, you'll be remembered forever. And he says, about 10 years. And I says, what do you mean? And he says, after you're dead about 10 years, people forget about you.
That humor, I miss it for sure. Yeah. So you were at the Idaho Falls Temple from what years?
2005 to 2008.
Okay, so this is, me and my wife were sealed in the Idaho Falls Temple in 2006. So you were at the helm of those keys when that happened. That, so it's definitely our favorite temple. We can definitely say that. So like on your records, are you still classified as a 70 or? And
you're still a general authority,
but you don't sit on the stand or anything like that.
No, the only time you preside is when you're presiding, you know. But you're just a regular member. But you're still a general authority.
Still hold that office,
and they still call you. Like just 2 weeks ago, Elder Ballard called me and said, I'd like you to go to a state conference with me and bear your testimony and bring Jane along. And I said, okay.
So fun.
Okay. And that happens occasionally, but not very often.
Yeah. And that's probably a nice gesture, and it's fun to interact with those brethren from time to time. So sort of the last final chapter as we close this interview off, there's so much here, and you could, just like you wrote a book about your time as a mission president, you could probably write a book about time as a temple president, which you sort of did. What stands out? What are we missing about the temple, generally speaking, that as leaders that we could better understand?
I think I'm not sure that we're missing it. It's maybe that it just hasn't sunk in as deep as it should. The temple is really, in a sense, I don't know whether the word vortex is right or not, but it's sort of the central point around which everything revolves. And I think we just haven't quite grasped that in the book, you know, that one of the things that lots of people have talked to me about that I mentioned is a lot of people in the temple would say, oh, President, I'm so sorry. I just love being in the temple. I hate to have to dress and go back out into the real world. And I remember kind of feeling there's something not quite right about that. And anyway, I won't go into detail, but in the book I mentioned, I said, it finally became very clear to me. No, it's exactly the opposite. The temple is the real world. Mm. You're leaving the real world and going out into the temporary world. The things out there are temporary. The things here are the eternal things. It's not that they can't be together, because you can do good things out there too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this is the center. This is what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's so reality, what lasts forever is here. And I think just that understanding that the importance of the temple,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And I guess that what led into the title of the book, which is Refuge and Reality.
Right.
Right. This is a refuge and it's reality.
Yeah.
The things that happen here are what are real.
Right? And what lasts forever. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, well, this has been fun, Elder Grover, to just sit down with you and ask you some questions. I know, you know, as a former bishop and in a state presidency, there's sometimes we general authorities can feel close at times, you know, as they visit. They can also sometimes feel distant. Nobody's at fault for that, but, you know, you're busy and you have your different things. So it's helpful to just understand, you know, the processes you go through, the principles you've learned, and see if we can maybe apply those principles.
Yeah.
The final question I have, which is sort of a traditional question I ask on the podcast, is as you have looked over your time as being in a leadership position, how has it made you a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned, not only the importance of temple, but the importance of family. I think my love for Jean and for the children, and to realize what an integral part when you think of the temple and you think of them being in the temple, those things are just extremely important. But I think associating with people, I've always felt myself down here and the brethren up here, kind of, you know, and yeah. Just to have that privilege of associating with great, great people. I mean, starting with President McKay, see, when I was a young missionary, he came and to our mission in Tonga, just shortly after he was made president of the church.
Wow.
And I had an opportunity to interact with President McKay. He knew my grandfather very well. In fact, I told you he went on the same boat with him on his mission.
Yeah, yeah.
President McKay got off in England, but my great-grandfather went on to Sweden for his mission. But with President McKay and then President Smith, well, all of the prophets, but not just the prophets, the brethren, I mean, they're all prophets, sure. The 12 and so forth. But to realize, yeah, they're men. A lot of times we say, well, they're ordinary men doing extraordinary things. I had a son-in-law that said, yeah, they're ordinary men doing extraordinary things. But when they do extraordinary things, they become extraordinary men.
Mm.
And I think that's the greatest blessing, is associating with people who are extraordinary in the sense of being true disciples of the Lord, and we could all do better on that.
Thank you, Elder Groberg. What a fantastic interview. I really enjoyed my time sitting down with Elder Groberg at his kitchen table and just asking him questions. I learned a lot, and I'm sure you did too. Hopefully this is the first of many of interviews that maybe we can line up with Emeritus 70s or currently serving 70s, whatever it be, because there's so much to learn from them and their counsel, and definitely stay tuned for that. Now, when I went to the early screening of the new movie, The Stray, Mitch Davis, who's the director, and like I said, the director of The Other Side of Heaven, he announced at that event that they're actually doing a sequel to The Other Side of Heaven, which covers the events of Elder Groberg's time as President Groberg when he went back to Tonga to serve as mission president. And as you can see, I'm sure they'll include the story about his son, which was inspiring and faith promoting, but a whole nother book on it. I got to check it out and read it, but soon you'll see it portrayed in a movie, The Other Side of Heaven 2, or maybe they'll think of a better name. I'm not sure. But so you'll definitely hear more of that in the years to come. I don't think they've even started filming yet, but Mitch Davis said it is happening. That's his next project. And I think it's a project worth making. As I mentioned before, we can't do this without you. Go to leadinglds.org, hit the donate button, become a core leader so that you can get access to the core feed, which will feature additional content, our webinars, and bonus episodes with all things leadership, with even more content to help you be the best leader that you can be. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.